Bottom line, the German political landscape is as fragmented and wide open as it has been in a decade and a half. And it's pretty exciting for all of us, whether we're in Germany or like me in Washington.
Welcome back to the Hopkins Podcast on Foreign Affairs, a completely student-run podcast at the Johns Hopkins University. My name is Samuel Koh, and today I'm joined by my two co-hosts, Lauren and Megan. Today we'll be discussing Germany after Merkel. Who is Angela Merkel? How did she change Germany during her 15 years in office? How will Germany be different under the next chancellor? Joining us today to answer these questions is Dr. Constanze Stützenmüller.
Constanze Stützenmüller is an expert on German, European, and transatlantic foreign and security policy and strategy. She is the inaugural holder of the Fritz Stern Chair on Germany and Transatlantic Relations in the Center on the United States and Europe at Brookings. She held the Kissinger Chair on Foreign Policy and International Relations at the Library of Congress and served as the inaugural Robert Borsch Senior Fellow at the Brookings Institute from 2014 to 2019. We hope you enjoy this episode of the Hopkins Podcast on Foreign Affairs.
Okay, so thank you for coming on to our podcast today, Constanze.
Thank you for having me on.
So, Constanze, Angela Merkel is stepping down from her position as German Chancellor after the federal election later this year. To start us off, could you give our listeners a brief overview of Angela Merkel's impact on German politics and what legacy she's leaving behind?
I'm laughing because I've just written an essay about that, and I found it quite difficult to condense that because, to me, so much of what she has done has been ambivalent. I think she's done many great things, but a lot of her most significant achievements have also come with a darker underside. And I can explain that. I think that she has unquestionably, in the 16 years since she took on the chancellorship of Germany in 2005, she has modernized her own party, the center-right Christian Democratic Union, or CDU. She has pushed it to the middle of German politics, thereby changing the German political landscape. She has undoubtedly overseen a tremendous rise in economic and political power of Germany within Europe. I think that also goes for Germany's influence and power on a more global level. It is seen as a key interlocutor by non-Western countries, for better or for worse. Yet, at the same time, many of her decisions, the decisions that shaped the country, I think the most notorious one, the best known one, is her decision to not close Germany's borders in the 2015 refugee crisis. That, I think, was a humanitarian decision that took a lot of pressure off of countries that were really struggling with the influx along the Balkans route and on Germany's borders. And I think that Germany, as the richest and most powerful country in Europe, had something like a moral obligation to take in these refugees. And that's the way the chancellor articulated this, and I believe her. And at the time, a lot of Germany's citizens agreed with that. But very quickly, it became clear that the country's institutions were really struggling with this, and people got upset. And this gave rise to a sort of terrifying change in what had hitherto been a small Eurosceptic party on the right, the Alternative for Germany, that was mainly critical of Germany's bailout policies in the Eurozone crisis, didn't like the common currency, the euro, and which in the migration crisis morphed to this raging xenophobic and anti-Semitic hard right party that developed networks across Europe and into America of hard right movements that associated itself with neo-Nazis and with identitarians and prepper movements and conspiracy theorists of all kinds, and entered the Bundestag, the federal legislature, for the first time in 2017 with 12.6%, which nobody had expected, and got even higher election results in some of Germany's eastern states. Those two things are related. Could the rise of the hard right have been prevented by keeping out the refugees? Should it have been? I don't think that's a judgment I want to make. But what I'm trying to explain using this one example is that some of the decisions that I think are admirable that Angela Merkel made in her tenure also had some really negative consequences.
And we will discuss the upcoming federal election soon. But first, you know, since Chancellor Merkel is stepping down soon, this past January, Chancellor Merkel's party, the Christian Democratic Union, the CDU, chose Armin Laschet as, you know, the new leader of the party. What can you tell us about him, and how does he differ from Chancellor Merkel and his predecessor, Annegret Kramp-Karrenbauer?
Let me first praise you for pronouncing all those names correctly.
Thank you.
One of the hardest things about being a German working in America is not laughing while somebody is trying to pronounce your name or the names of your fellow Germans. So seriously, kudos for that.
Thank you.
But so one thing that for me was somewhat personally amusing about the selection process of the new CDU party leader is that this was a choice between three men, Friedrich Merz, Norbert Röttgen, and Armin Laschet. And as a Politico piece pointed out at the time, they were all lawyers in their late 50s, early 60s, with three kids and musical interests. And then I remember reading that and thinking, wait a moment. And then I Googled a little bit and I realized, yes, I had gone to law school in Bonn, the then capital of Western Germany, with all three of them. Not at the same time. And I had a graduate school stint in America in between. But I think I know that I was a contemporary of Laschet and of Merz, and Röttgen came later after I had come back and was a tutor. So what that meant was that I know the political landscape from which these guys come. And a lot of the media reporting about the choice of Laschet was, this is a continuation of Merkel with other means. He's a male Merkel because he's centrist, he's incrementalist, he's cautious, he is a balancer between East and West. And I think all of that is correct, yet it fails to grasp one really important difference, which is that Angela Merkel was an East German and really a very, very unlikely choice to become Germany's second longest serving chancellor at this point, because she was the first woman, she was the first East German, she's a physicist. She didn't have any of the networks or sort of tribal affiliations that have been so important in post-war West German politics. And not just that, she also really, while seeming centrist and incrementalist, made some really revolutionary decisions and choices and shaped the country in very important ways. Whereas it seems to me that Armin Laschet is a throwback to pre-German reunification politics. He's the governor of North Rhine-Westphalia, a very populous Western German state. And the law school that we all went to in the former capital, Bonn, is in North Rhine-Westphalia. And to my mind, he's really a throwback. His entire career has been characterized by these very powerful regional and also religious networks. Let me explain this. If you were young and ambitious and wanted to have a political career in the German Conservative Party, you were probably going to be as a student, you'd have a fellowship from the Konrad Adenauer Foundation, which is the Conservative Party Foundation. You would probably spend a number of summers going to their famous seminars on, they were called rhetoric seminars, but really they were on political communication and speech making and strategy. And you were probably also going to be a member of a fraternity. And in the case of Catholics, which are a strong group in North Rhine-Westphalia, you were going to be in a Catholic fraternity. And all that is true for Armin Laschet. He, in fact, before he went into politics, was the editor of a diocesan newspaper in the bishopric of Aachen, which is very close to the Franco-German border. So to my mind, he is an embodiment of traditional West German male-centric power networks. And I think that it may be one of the reasons why he's had a lackluster start as the leader of the CDU in a time of national crisis, pandemic, economic crisis, and really in many ways, a moment of political and social transition as well.
So as we've mentioned, Germany will hold federal elections later this year. Which parties appear to be leading, and how do you anticipate the election to unfold in the next few months?
Well, that also is a question that is more complex than it might seem. For months now, until quite recently, German polls were extremely stable, astoundingly stable. They showed a very clear lead for Angela Merkel's CDU. The next most successful party, the CDU was around 35% in a six-party landscape. Then the Greens came in at somewhere between 20 and 22. The Social Democrats, the center-left former Popular Party, which is the coalition partner of Merkel and has been its coalition partner in the so-called Grand Coalition for three out of her four terms. The Social Democrats were at around 15-16%, which in terms of their historic political weight is nearly tragic. And then you had the Alternative for Germany, the hard right party that I've already mentioned, at somewhere around 10, really plateauing. And the Liberals and Die Linke, which is the inheritor party of the East German Communist Party, at somewhere between, say, 6-8%. And just to complicate things, I should say that the Christian Democratic Party has a Bavarian sister party, the Christian Social Union, because, you know, Bavaria is kind of like Texas. They do things their way. And, you know, why be in the big party if you can have your own party? But technically, their poll shares are always counted together with the National Christian Democratic Party. So anyway, you had a very stable situation where for months, everybody thought that the next German government was going to be one with a conservative chancellor and a green junior coalition partner, which would have been the first time in German post-war history. The Greens have been in government once with Social Democrats in 1998 to 2005, but that was the only time. And right now, we've just come out of two regional elections this past Sunday on March 14th, which were in many ways a bellwether for what is a super election year in Germany. We have a total of six regional elections, one more in the summer in the East, and then three at the same time as the national elections on September 26th. And these two bellwether elections last Sunday were in Baden-Württemberg and in Rhineland-Palatinate. Again, I apologize for these very long German names, but they're both reasonably wealthy West German states where the CDU, the conservative party of Angela Merkel, has deep historic roots. And the Baden-Württemberg party is a really powerful one because Baden-Württemberg is the powerhouse of German industry and exports. And the Palatinate CDU produced Helmut Kohl, the chancellor, who shepherded the two Germanys into reunification in 1990. And in both of these states last Sunday, the CDU got its worst ever results since the end of the war. It got hammered. Part of that was due to the fact that the incumbents in both states, which were reelected, a Green minister president in Baden-Württemberg and a Social Democrat one in Rhineland and Palatinate were really popular and were thought by citizens there to have done a good job of managing the state, and particularly in a pandemic, calmly, effectively. So there was, these were expected outcomes. But the weakness of the CDU in these polls still came as an unpleasant surprise. And that has a couple of, that raises new questions for the possible outcomes of the September elections. One is whether Armin Laschet will actually become the candidate of the CDU going into the elections. I think that that aspiration of his has just been given a major dent. And there is a dark horse waiting in the wings, the minister president of Bavaria, Markus Söder, who has sort of been energetically engaging in non-denials of his ambition to replace Laschet for months now. And they have said that they will come to a decision between Easter and Pentecost, both important religious holidays in Germany. So Easter is April 4th and Pentecost is May 23rd. And so by May 23rd, hopefully we will know who the conservative candidate will be. But the I think the fair assumption is that the enormous advantage of the CDU in the polls currently is due mainly to respect for Angela Merkel, which also has been tanking a little bit. So there, I think there is now, after Sunday, a considerable uncertainty as to the ability of the CDU to field a chancellor candidate who is compelling to the electorate in September. And because the Liberals, who have really for the past 10, 15 years struggled to define their role, suddenly got a bump in these elections, there is suddenly, and for the first time, the prospect of a coalition at national level that might not include the CDU. And that would be a coalition which we call a traffic light coalition, because it would be green, red, yellow. The Greens obviously being the green, the Social Democrats' color is red, and the Liberals' color is yellow. And the interesting thing here is that, at least based on current polling, the senior partner in such a coalition would be the Greens, and the Social Democrats and the Liberals would be the junior partners. Now, three-way coalitions are have never been done on the national level before. They tend to be very hard to negotiate. And it's still the more likely case that there will be a conservative green coalition, but there's going to be competition for it in September. So bottom line, the German political landscape is as fragmented and wide open as it has been in a decade and a half. And it's pretty exciting for all of us, whether we're in Germany or like me in Washington.
So kind of moving back to Chancellor Merkel, during her term, she ran on a platform of strengthening international relations in NATO and the EU, domestic energy diversification, and public investment. So what sort of advancements did Chancellor Merkel make towards strengthening the EU and NATO?
Well, that too is ambivalent. I mean, you have to say that, let me start with the EU. Angela Merkel was widely criticized for Germany's austerity policies during the Eurozone crisis, which was the European manifestation of the global financial crisis of 2008 and 2009, and which really was led to the necessity for bailouts for several southern European countries, Portugal, and most notably Greece. And there was a huge debate and conflict within Europe and much criticism of the Germans for insisting on fiscal austerity reforms in these countries as the price for European bailouts. But I think that critique is only partially correct. What it misses is that there was a real demand in Germany, but also in some of the fiscally frugal European countries like the Baltic states or the Netherlands or the Nordic states, to throw out countries that required bailouts from the European Union. And this is something, and again, there was a real sort of German movement for that. There's a big German tabloid called Bildzeitung, which was calling for this and really sort of whipping up popular opinion against the bailouts. And I think one of Merkel's signature achievements was to stand her ground against this and to insist that the Greeks in particular had to stay within the European Union. And I think that is, again, you know, it took a great deal of courage and nerves from her. And I think it was the right thing for her to do. I think one point where I think Germany under her leader has for once played an unequivocally positive role is in putting its weight behind the 827 billion euro, sorry, dollar recovery package that was negotiated last summer in the first half of the pandemic, which required Germany and in particular Merkel's Conservative Party giving up its decades-long resistance to European common bonds, in other words, to permitting the European Union to raise funds on the capital markets as part of this recovery package. That was something that the frugal countries in Europe, the so-called frugal four or frugal five, depending on how you count them, were absolutely dead set against. And the Germans throwing their weight behind this made the difference. And I think it's no exaggeration to say that that saved the European Union at this point. That's not to say that other things can't sort of, you know, undermine it. But and I think we will be grappling with the social, economic, and political impacts of the pandemic for years, maybe decades to come. So this is, you know, just one step in something in a much larger trajectory. But that I think is genuinely an achievement for the history books. And I think that she also played a rather significant role in preventing a no-deal Brexit. That was something where I think some European capitals, like Paris, were much more willing to let the Brits go, leave the European Union without a deal. And I think that for the Germans was a non-negotiable. Let me come to your other question, which is the impact on NATO. I think we're in a more ambivalent territory. Germany, like all other NATO member states, promised at the Wales summit in 2014, under the impression of Russia's illegal annexation of Crimea and its support of a proxy war in eastern Ukraine and the Donbas, to up their defense payments by 2% of GDP by 2024. And Germany has really been struggling to do this. That said, it's tried really hard. And it is, I think, it has doubled its defense budget in recent years, which by German standards, and particularly by German political standards, is extraordinary. If you'd asked me 5 or 10 years ago whether Germany was ever going to do that, I would have said that strikes me as impossible. But we're still only at, I think, 1.5%. And we have 3 more years to go. Do I think we're going to make another half percentage until 2024? Probably not. The German government says that's may take us until 2031. Does that weaken NATO? Sure it does, because it seems like an ambivalent commitment at a time when it is incredibly important because of all the because of the rise of adversarially of adversarial great powers like Russia and China, incredibly important to keep NATO together. And what Germany does or does not do in this context really, really matters for the European side of burden sharing. That said, I will say that I think that that Germany's take on its own strategic situation and Europe's strategic situation really has changed over the past 5 years. I've been one of the commentators who's, you know, been banging on this drum for a while. I've always felt that Germans overlearned the lessons of German reunification. Famously, the German defense minister at the time, Volker Rühe, said, "We're now surrounded and we're encircled by friends now." And I think Germans, more even than Americans and other Europeans, thought that reunification and the end of the Cold War meant that eternal peace had now arrived, and that really defense budgets and armed forces weren't necessary anymore. Not realizing that the enlargement of the EU and of NATO had simply pushed Germany's security risks out to the periphery, and that because they were now surrounded by European countries and NATO member states that were rapidly democratizing in Eastern Europe, they felt that less than before. But I think that that misperception has changed completely, not least because Russia and China have been engaged in so much meddling, supporting corruption, disinformation, propaganda, and other things within Europe and indeed within Germany. And the German strategic community is very concerned about that.
So building upon Germany's strategic situation, what have been some of the key points of contention between Germany and Russia? And how are these contentions been addressed during Chancellor Merkel's administration?
When Angela Merkel became chancellor in 2005, the framing, the narrative of Germany's relationship with Russia was dominated by two things. One, the fact that, if I'm not mistaken, 10 million Russians had died at least in World War II and the Holocaust. And that the Germans felt that there was a special need for atonement there as well. And the other aspect was this idea that came up after the fall of the Berlin Wall and the dissolution of the Warsaw Pact and the end of the Soviet Union, that all of Eastern Europe, including Russia, was on this sort of vector of transformation that would lead them to become like us. Now, both of these framings were profoundly problematic. For one, the focus on the Soviet war dead, I think, always somehow elided the fact that as what historian Timothy Snyder has called the Bloodlands, where the greatest number of human beings were killed by the Nazis and by Soviet troops, were in Poland and in Ukraine and in Lithuania. And it has always been a subject of anger and distrust in our Eastern European neighbors that we should feel such empathy, or that German political elites should express such empathy with Russians, but not with Lithuanians, Ukrainians, or Poles. Now, again, I don't want to generalize that. That's also a point of critique in German political debate. And there are a lot of people who, like me, say, you can't empathize with the one, but not with the other. That is indecent and immoral. But I think I'm just describing one important basis for this relationship. And in fact, the German president, Frank-Walter Steinmeier, alluded to that only a couple weeks ago in a speech, and was roundly criticized for this by the German media, who were quick to pounce and say, so what about all the other people that were killed by the Nazis? Why always focus on this group? The problem with the notion of transformation, of course, this tied in with this whole theory of the end of history and everybody wanting to become like us, was that it completely missed the degree to which the transition from Boris Yeltsin to Vladimir Putin in Russia meant the erection of a highly authoritarian, corrupt power system based on fossil fuel, rent income, and a social contract, which provided security and economic security and some mobility to citizens while depriving them of essential political freedoms. And I will say that that what's changed since 2014, well, I would say it began in 2008 with the Russo-Georgian War. That, I think, first made the Germans a little bit jumpy. Mikhail Saakashvili, the then president of Georgia, was unpopular in Germany, was seen as an unsafe pair of hands. But the fact that the Russians were willing to annex parts of Georgian territory really raised some antennae in Berlin. But it was the annexation of Crimea and the proxy war in the Donbass, which, let me remind you, is still ongoing and has claimed more than 10,000 dead. And we don't even know the numbers of Russian dead because those are kept a national secret. And there are Russian mercenaries troops operating in the Donbass. It is that really sort of started the shift in Berlin. So what used to be termed a strategic partnership with Russia was canceled in 2014. And then there are a number of subsequent actions. The hack of the German Bundestag, the federal legislature's servers in 2015 by a foreign adversary. It took us unconscionably long to attribute that, but it was attributed last year to the GRU, in other words, the Russian intelligence services. Then the murder of a father and daughter couple in England, the Skripals, with Novichok, or the attempted murder, I'm sorry, they have survived, thank God. Also attributed to the GRU. Then the murder in broad daylight in the Central Park of Berlin, the Tiergarten, of a Chechen refugee by a GRU contract killer. And the continued attempts to influence German politics and most lately the 2017 elections through organs of propaganda and disinformation, Russian media like Sputnik and Russia Today. All of that has, I think, changed the take of German policymakers on Russia and made it much darker and much more pessimistic. That said, you also all know that when in the summer, when Russian military intelligence attempted to kill the opposition leader Alexei Navalny with Novichok on a flight in Siberia, Angela Merkel had him flown to Germany, treated there, and had him recover there, to the great anger of the Kremlin. So the Kremlin keeps saying how disappointed they are in Berlin and that the Germans are no longer their preferred friends in Europe. That suggests that the Kremlin has finally gotten the message. But what I haven't mentioned now, and of course you want me to mention that, is Nord Stream 2, which is a natural gas pipeline being built between Russia and the Baltics. It's being built undersea through the Baltics, and it's 95% completed right now. It's supposed to come on land in a German Baltic seaport. And the political purpose of this, of course, is to essentially render redundant the Ukrainian gas transit route, which would deprive Ukraine of a lot of transit fee income that is a pretty large chunk of its national budget. And in the view of many of the pipeline's critics, renders Ukraine vulnerable to more Russian meddling. And there is a bipartisan Senate attempt to get the Biden administration to sanction the five European companies involved in the building of this pipeline, which is operated by the Russian state-owned gas company Gazprom. That's a huge fight, which has been ongoing for years now, and I think right now is coming to a head. that, I, in my view, is permitting this pipeline to be built, in my view, was a, and describing it as a solely economic project, was one of the biggest mistakes Angela Merkel has made in her tenure. I think at this point, everybody in Berlin understands that from the Russian side, it's seen as a political project, but actually stopping it or mitigating its political impact is more complicated than you would think. I'm happy to expand on that.
Well, thank you for this. And I'd like to turn next to another geopolitical actor on the stage, which is China. What has been Germany's and Chancellor Merkel's stance towards China thus far, and how do you expect that stance to change?
China is Germany's biggest export market after the rest of the EU. It used to be rest of the EU, America, and China. Now China, I think, is in second place. For a lot of German key industries, like the car industry, China is an essential growth market, without which they would be in a much worse place economically. And because the car industry is a mainstay of the German economy, that involves a lot of jobs and that has political implications. It's hard for a German chancellor to take stances that the car industry doesn't agree with. Let me put it that way. But here too, the sense that Germany could somehow help transform China into a political economy that would liberalize not just economy, would liberalize not just its economy, but also its politics, which I think some people genuinely believed in the 1990s. That has been, I think, just thrown overboard by the tenure of Xi Jinping, the Chinese president, who has turned China into a really hardline authoritarian surveillance state with a very aggressively assertive foreign policy that clearly seeks to remake the rules of the international order to make them friendly, into a friendly environment for the Chinese Communist Party, and that also has no qualms in acquiring physical and digital real estate in Europe, and then using these pressure points to try and influence European politics to its advantage. And that said, I think the assessment of what China is doing in the world and in Europe has become a lot darker, a lot more critical in Berlin recently than it had been for a long time. And in fact, I would go so far as to say that there is now a groundswell among most of the parties represented in the legislature that is critical of a too lenient relationship with China, that says we need to make ourselves more resilient. We need to make sure that there are certain, that the Chinese can't play us, that we have supply security for critical components, and that those aren't in Chinese ownership. And one thing that has, I think, reinforced this harsher tone in Berlin is the Chinese overplaying their hand. You have no doubt heard the term wolf diplomacy, which has been applied to sort of the much more overt, overtly demanding, aggressive, bullying tone of Chinese ambassadors in Europe. And notably, when China's foreign minister Wang Yi came to Berlin at the end of last August, he had a joint press conference with the German foreign minister Heiko Maas, where Heiko Maas said to him, we are willing to respect our foreign interlocutors, but we expect the same from them. And threats are unacceptable. And when he was referring to the fact that Wang Yi had just come from the Czech Republic, from Czechia, and had openly threatened the Czech government for its what he thought were anti-Chinese policies. So the German government has also been much more sort of overtly critical of Chinese bullying of the democracy movement in Hong Kong, bullying of the democratic government in Taiwan, and so on. So I think that there is a shift in the mood there, but right now the chancellery, and that includes the Chancellor Angela Merkel, is the holdout here. It won't have escaped you that Germany, while it held the EU presidency in the last half of 2020, negotiated under some pressure a European-Chinese investment agreement called the CAI with Beijing just before the end of its presidency that came in for a lot of criticism from the Biden transition team. I would say that that doesn't preclude, because it's relatively limited. And I think, you know, it gives the Chinese a symbolic win. The timing is extremely unfortunate, but in substance, I think it doesn't at all preclude a cooperation between the Biden administration and Europe and Berlin on attempting to, shall we say, push back on the influence of China in the West. But was it unfortunate in its optics? Absolutely.
So kind of building off of what you just said about the Biden administration, so with the new Biden administration and also the changing German leadership, how will these changes affect U.S.-German relationships as well as the U.S. Relationship with the EU?
Well, let me put, I'm a little frustrated by this personally, I will say, because the 4 years of the Trump administration were pretty scary for the Europeans, because it became clear quite quickly that the different factors operating in the Trump administration were all sort of bad for or hostile towards Europe and the European Union in general, and Germany in particular. The economic nationalists were keen on weaponizing economic interdependence between America and the EU to put pressure on the European Union. This was also a personal obsession of President Trump's, who was convinced that the European Union was really a German front to cheat American manufacturers. And the ethno-nationalist faction, the Stephen Millers of this world, and the Stephen Bannons, were sort of propagating this view of a culture war narrative of American alliances, where suddenly the authoritarian governments or movements in Europe were of much greater interest to the White House than its NATO allies were. In other words, the Hungarians, the extremely conservative government in Poland were treated with enormous favor. And if you look at what President Orban of Hungary has done in Hungary, essentially, you know, rewritten the constitution to institute a one-party state. And if you listen to his speeches, which, you know, could have been written by Steve Bannon, that was shocking to many Europeans. It was also really shocking when Secretary of State Pompeo went to Brussels in December 2018 and gave a speech at the German Marshall Fund in which he suggested that the European Union might need to be disbanded because it wasn't in the interests of its citizens. That is something no Secretary of State has ever done, and I would add should not do. And so it's clear that the Biden administration is the opposite of all that, ethno-nationalism is alien to it. I think economic nationalism is a little more complicated because the Biden administration's team clearly has some protectionist impulses, which I think might include the president. And I think in a perhaps even understandably in a period of national economic crisis. But what that means is that transatlantic trade issues and technology competition issues are going to become quite complicated to negotiate. But at least I think we have every reason to be grateful that the Biden administration thinks of Europe as partners and allies in every important way, and beginning with the fact that we are Western democracies based on representation, the rule of law, separation of powers, and the protection of individual rights and liberties. And that they value Europeans as providers of leverage and legitimacy, that they value the European Union as an aggregator of leverage, if you will, and an aggregator of power that is can be of real importance in America in conflicts with authoritarian adversaries that are not carried out with military means, but through the weaponization of economic interdependence. That's where the European Union becomes a real power factor. And so it seems to me that we have every reason as Europeans to work together with this administration. And yet I think there is a real sense of urgency because of the events of January 6th, the insurrection of the Capitol, because there is a sense that this has not gone away. It's that this sort of radical populist authoritarian impulse is very much still there, that there's still a huge power struggle in the GOP. It's not clear what happens in the midterms or in the 2024 elections. And so I think democratic nations everywhere, not just in Europe, have a real interest in helping the Biden administration succeed in its endeavors. And I have to tell you, I think we're not doing enough.
Constanze, thank you so much for walking us through the complicated politics of Germany before and after Merkel today.
I'm sorry they're so complicated. I'm sorry the names are so complicated, but it was a pleasure. Thank you very much for hosting me.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of the Hopkins Podcast on Foreign Affairs. I hope you enjoyed it. We'd like to say thank you to the International Studies Program at Johns Hopkins University and the SNF and Gorey Institute at Johns Hopkins University for making this episode possible. Remember to follow us on social media at Hopkins POFA on Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok for the latest and greatest of Hopkins POFA content. Hit follow on Spotify, subscribe on iTunes, and leave a rating. We'll see you next time.